Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight, where David Thurley makes a welcome return. He thanked the Prime Minister at our annual dinner in 2014, but it's good to have him here to give a speech. He's well known to all of you, so I will introduce him quickly. His background was with IBM Australia, became the CEO of Telstra, currently the chairman of the CSIRO, also chairman of Jobs for New South Wales, and chairman of Venture Capital for Square Pegs. And tonight, David Thurley is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic of 100 years of disruption, technology and science. David Thurley, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I've never spoken to the Sydney Institute before, and it's a wonderful institution and always a pleasure to come here, so thank you very much for the warm welcome. Now, I should put your fears to rest. I'm not going to do a 100-year chronology of the history of science and innovation in Australia or at CSIRO, but what I do want to do is to talk a little bit about CSIRO. As I said, I am chairman of CSIRO, and what I find is a lot of people do not understand what this wonderful institution does. And I'm going to try and take you through a bit of a journey of what it does do. Now, there's a lot in CSIRO, and that's the problem. So I hope you stay with me as I go through this presentation. It is interesting. It's just on 100 years since CSIRO's conception was presented by Billy Hughes in 1916 in Melbourne. And I'm going to start with a quote because it still resonates with me. And it is wonderful how life doesn't really change in 100 years when you see here this. So what he said, he was talking in Melbourne, he said, "We must create conditions that will attract and maintain a virile population, of whom a sufficient number must settle on the land because of the agricultural area, and I know of no way of settling people on the land except to make rural industry attractive. And to this, science can lend a most powerful aid. Science can make rural industries commercially profitable, making the desert bloom like a rose. It can make rural life pleasant as well as profitable. But science can develop great mineral wealth, of which, after oil, the rich outcrop is yet to be exploited. It can, with its magic wand, turn heaps of what is termed refuse into gold, and by utilization of byproducts, make what was unprofitable to work profitably. Science will lead the manufacturer into green pastures by solving problems that seemed insoluble. It will open up 1,000 new avenues for capital and labor. And lastly, science thus familiarized to the people, help them to have clear thinking, rejection of shams, to healthier and better lives, and to a saner and wider outlook on life." So science was obviously the answer to all those challenges that they had in 1916. So what I'm trying to say is science plays such a critical role in the development of industries, in the development of our society, and yet many of us don't know. Because science, about what it really does, and because science is the discovery of life and really what goes on and how to create value. So I think the vision was really quite inspired, and I'm going to come back to it later on. Very interesting, though, and this is something that people don't realise, about 1916 it was going through an enormous period of disruption. And I should say, what do you think that disruption was? It was the end of the Industrial Revolution. But it was the arrival of the mass-produced automobile. Now, many people say it was the Model T, but actually others will say it was the Oldsmobile. But just think about what the power of the arrival of an automobile really meant. Because It was about, what, 8 years before that speech, 1908, when the Model T really started to come out in mass production. By the way, as an aside, I understand the first kit set Model T was built in Australia in 1908, and the assembly plant that Ford set up was established in 1925. So it was still, you know, quite early days. But what was fascinating about that disruption was that with the beginning of the, you know, automobile, it was a whole new industry was created, the automobile industry. And what an incredible success. And how many jobs did that generate, you know, right around the world? But also, it destroyed industries. It destroyed industries. So you didn't find as many horse stables. Those people who were building buggies just suddenly disappeared. The horse market didn't really, you know, take off. In fact, if you watch that video on YouTube, anyone watched it, Humans Need Not Apply? Have you seen that one? It's a book written by Humans Need Not Apply. It's about automation and the changing nature of jobs, which is very dear to my heart. And it actually tracks the population of horses from 1915 to now, and literally it's just come off a cliff. I mean, the number of horses in the world are a whaler. So, you know, and there's this wonderful little clip that of two horses talking to each other, saying, as a Model T goes past, saying, "Oh, they tell us we're going to have more leisure time, so don't worry." You know, so, it's a classic clip, isn't it? Anyway, but it destroyed industries, but also, what people forget is it changed the nature of other industries. So if you think about, you know, the hospitality industry, agriculture, mining, travel, automation, you know, the car changed things. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because the other part of science is digital disruption. And I'm going to give you a little lesson in digital disruption, and I'm sorry for those who are not technically inclined, but I've got to mention it, because we are facing this enormous technology change, digital disruption, but it's not new. What I worry about is people can say, digital disruption's changing the world. We've been through many, many different changes in terms of disruption of industry, and this is just another one. So the question is, what do you do with it, not with this happening? But there is something quite special and I about what's going on, because I am a technologist at heart, and I apologize. I started as a systems engineer at IBM, which you probably don't know what it was. It just used to design computers. But there's eight trends that I'm going to go through really quickly and that you do need to know about. Firstly, is the cost of computing has come down. So those who are there with your iPads or, you know, taking notes diligently, I mean, that's got the power of a computer. When I started at IBM in, 1979, it's more powerful than the computers we sell for literally tens of million dollars. And then, of course, we have the wonderful quantum computing going on out at New South Wales University, which has enormous hope of, a whole new generational change of computing. That's real innovation, and I like that. The second thing is that our connectivity, you know, you all have your mobile phones. I won't ask you how many of you got two mobile phones, but some of you will. It is just this, the world of connectivity, the way we interact with information has just changed radically. There's still about, 2.5-3 billion people who don't have access to the internet in the world today. But, gee, it has changed. I mean, many of you may want to throw it away, but you can't because you need it. And remember what is different about this. Remember, and it's a very simple principle, when the fixed line phone, your number was a physical location. This is very apparent, but just think, this is what? Is you. There's one number and it relates to you. And that has changed the dynamics of information flow more than you realize, because things have become more personalized. So connectivity. I won't talk about the third one, software techniques. That's a bit, sort of geeky, but it's okay to be a geek these days. The second one is just the enormous amount of information we're now collecting. Now, this is very relevant to science, because when you talk about the scientific method, I'm sure there'll be some scientists here, it is nothing more than collecting data and getting what? To a predictable outcome. Chemical reactions, it's all about a predictable outcome. But when you collect a lot of data, you start to get better insights into information. And now with bigger computing and fast communication, you can actually analyze things. Now, and that comes the second, it's number seven, but it doesn't matter. Artificial intelligence. A lot of people say to me, artificial intelligence is going to change the world. Yes, it is going to change the world. But I want you to remember it's nothing more than an algorithm dealing with large amounts of data at very high speed. That's all it is. Now, yes, you can start to take into human characteristics, but RTP or machine learning is nothing new. In fact, I did algorithms back when I was a programmer. So don't get... It is enormously important in terms of business, and I think it's going to change, just like the automobile, change so much. But it isn't anything that is human-like. It may be able to give... different, better ability to recall, like Google is just a search engine, and I use it like an extension of my memory, and I hope you do, or if you're doing a quiz, it's a great thing to go to. But that's just about collecting lots of data and then having a very fast algorithm to get access to it, and then doing some what-if questions. So artificial intelligence is very important. Robotics and automation are different because robotics is happening very quickly. And I don't know if you've ever come across Pepper or the other Sumi out of Japan, but these are very, very clever robots, physical robots with very smart technology, and they are making an enormous difference. And then you've got this other ability called voice recognition and cognitive computing, which is about just the interaction between yourself and a machine has changed enormously. So today, do many of you use Siri on your phone? Okay, well, here's a little story. So I use a product called, it's called Alexa. It's called Amazon Echo. Does anyone use Amazon Echo? Okay, you see, there's just one people. We need to get you up into this technology world. Now, it sits on my desk at home, and I walk in, and I say, Alexa, tell me what's in my diary today. Alexa says, in your diary, it's very slow but boring. I say, Alexa, what's the weather going to be like today? And she says, today in Sydney it will be 16 to 19 degrees, it will be a grey overcast day, whatever it is. But it's fascinating the way it has changed my life. It is just that interaction of with a machine that sits on a desk. It's not a phone that I pull out and I talk to you, that's too difficult an action. I just walk in. And it's like having another person in the room. My wife isn't too enthusiastic about it, but it has just changed the dynamic. So, what I'm saying here, and then you add virtual reality, augmented reality, technology is a disruptor. Now, what I want to talk about tonight, and I'm going to try and sit down by 6:30 so it doesn't take too long. CSIRO, the Commonwealth Science Industrial Research Organization, has been at the forefront of disruption and scientific research for 100 years. And the question is, how does it stay at the forefront of that? Because for Australia, it is very important that we do. Now, many of you probably don't know CSIRO, so if I said to you, how big is CSIRO? Well, it's roughly about 6,000 people. It has a budget of $1.2 billion every year. $1.2 billion. We get 800, depending on what the budget's like, $800, $850 million in appropriations. And then we generate, with partnerships, the remainder up to the $1.2 billion. It is still seen as one of the most eminent research organisations in the world. And many other countries have broken this research capabilities up into different groups and then split them out. Like if you're in New Zealand and in the UK, they split them up and they ran them independently. So agriculture went off to the agricultural group under the department. Energy went off into the energy group. And they lost the economies of scale because the truth about science, whether you're a physicist, a chemist, or a mechanical engineer, more and more it's about the collaboration of these wonderful professionals working together to solve problems. It is not purely that pursuit of chemistry or physics. So what I thought I'd quickly cover tonight is, what is CSIRO doing? That's the first one. The second I'm going to do is what CSIRO is doing under the National Innovation Science Agenda, which is quite interesting. And then thirdly, I'll just touch on the future of where CSIRO sees the future going, because that is really important. There's quite a lot of changes happening within the science community about where we should go. Sound okay? Okay. Now, the first one is difficult. So if I said to you, in April last year, there were 9 key focus areas announced by the government. And I'm sure you can all recite them because these are our growth sectors of the future. But they were food, soil and water, transport, cybersecurity, energy, manufacturing, resources, environmental change, and health. Interestingly, they are the nine divisions, or roughly the nine divisions that exist within CSIRO, and have done for probably the last 30 years. Now, and what they do is primarily research and development, but I want to be very clear. CSIRO's one objective is to partner with industry to create value for this country. Now, where you get a challenge is this difference between pure science, which is the pursuit of science for its own end, versus what we call applied science, which is science to make a difference within industry. And you can apply that to many different industries. And what CSIRO was set up to make a difference for Australia and to be a servant, I would say a servant, to industry. However, it hasn't always done that. In fact, often it has become a bit of an end in itself. It has at times become... Is anyone from CSIRO here tonight? There probably is, yeah. Right. And at times it's gone through. And it's had a very difficult sort of, you know, balancing of that, because if I talk to some of the scientists at CSIRO today, they'll say, "Ah, oh, David, you know, we've forgotten the national good of you know, what CSIRO does. We're not there." National good is good, but you need to apply it to make a difference. And the best example is that I can think is like Pasteur was a great microbiologist. He was a microbiologist, wasn't he? But what he did was to apply that chemistry, that science, to make a difference, you know, to society. And that's what we've got. We've got to be good at both. So there's been a lot of discussion around, which I'll talk about in a moment, the NISA, which is about greater commercialization of science. Now, because when we track against the OECD countries, we score very, very well in terms of our scientists. In fact, Australian scientists would rate up in the top 5% of the world, and they are wonderful. In fact, I must say, the value in CSIRO is our people, our scientists. But the issue is that we are very poor at collaboration. I'm seeing Stephen here. We are shocking. We do not like partner with each other. And the problem with Australia is we have so many great initiatives, but none of them talk to each other. It, you know, I blame Federation completely for it. It is just, we are just over-governed and we don't get good coordination. And then we don't have good communication between industry, from research in universities. It is just shocking. I spend most of the time when I go into a meeting on this area trying to work out where people fit in. I got growth centres, I got CRCs, I got knowledge centres. You don't know what these are, but it doesn't matter. And then I've got centres of competence in universities. You know, how many universities in Australia? 40. I love them all dearly, but I'm not sure I need 40. And then you've got CSIRO off doing off in its own thing. And we as a country need to find a way to come together to address the big problems. So just a very quick sort of quick scenario. So what are we doing? Well, I'm going to go through these nine areas very quickly. So bear with me. I literally will just touch on. So in agriculture, which is food, we mentioned before, but for us that's ag, food and nutrition. We do an enormous amount of work in both in animals and, you know, we've done a lot of work in cotton, wheat. You know, done a lot of the genomics and that in terms of we have, you know, some of the best cotton in the world, you know, consumes the least amount of water, very pest resistant, best in the world. I mean, when I say best, I'm not just saying because it's nice, it is the best in the world. And now we're doing a lot in aquaculture because aquaculture, A-Q-U-A culture, has got to be a growth industry, both salmon, prawn and all that area. Enormous opportunity, but we've got to apply ourselves to as we go forward. Soil and water is very important because if we don't get soil and water right, one of the great things that has been a combination of things we've done within that division is a new app called Soil Map, where you can actually, you know, on your farm, look at the soil quality on that farm. So if you're growing cotton or wheat, you can get this app down, look at the quality of the soil and determine what you're going to grow or what fertilizer you're going to put on it. These are really big changes. And we're going to change the way we actually deliver agriculture. Transport has been an enormous area. Done a lot in that area over the years. You know, the latest one we've been doing, well, actually, this is a few years old now, the road crack imaging technology, where we have cars running around New South Wales looking for cracks in roads. You know, at great speeds, we put them underneath a truck and report back when the road's got a little millimetre thing. Then they get out and fix it. Really great. You know, how we move things around Australia, we've got some great apps in that area. So, look, these are really important things that are changing what you often don't see is how we become more efficient and more effective in these areas. You know, the fourth area has been cybersecurity. I mentioned, I'm not sure if you realize, but within CSIRO was an organization called NICTA, the National Information Communications Technology Group. See, it wasn't NICTA. But it's now called Data 61. But this does is the Cybersecurity Growth Center for Australia. This is very important about the future because in terms of cybercrime, denial of services when you these websites get addressed, we need to be a global leader in this area. We cannot, you know, abdicate our responsibility because every day there are attacks that we need to be aware of. Energy, we're doing a lot of work in. It's an enormous area. But we go right from energy production through to how we're going to a zero emissions world. And this is really a challenge. So we're doing a lot of work in coal, how we can manage CO2 emissions there, how we can still, you know, mine coal but actually find a way to produce energy without so many emissions. So we're trying to change the technology in that area. We're also doing a lot of work in renewables. Battery life is really important. This has changed the world. I drive a hybrid car, and I tell you, it is. If you aren't driving hybrid cars yet, you should try one. At least go and drive one. If you haven't driven a Tesla, they love giving you a test drive in a Tesla. They are a lot of fun, even just for the joy of doing it. You don't need to buy one. They're still a bit expensive at the moment. But this is big. These are big changes that we as a nation have got to be at the front of, not sitting down at the behind. Manufacturing, I'm just going to mention one. And if you're on the web, there's a wonderful website within CSIRO called CSIRO7, which is sort of some of our younger PhD students who have done a lot of work. But we've been doing some work in an area called MOF. Now, these are called metallic organic frameworks. They are amazing. And these are got metal atoms with organic, and they have this incredible surface area that we're going to change a lot of the way we actually, you know, absorb or take up CO2 or impurities from a lot of the production that we do. It's absolutely incredible. So you can get a 1 gram of these crystals, and they will cover, they have a surface area around 5,000 square meters. So 1 gram is the same surface area of MCG. I should have said SCG, but the SCG is a bit small. These are really game-changing technologies, and most Australians have no idea what we're doing, and we do not celebrate our scientists enough on what we're doing. So look at CSIRO7. It's really interesting. I won't talk about resources. We're doing a lot of discussion around where CSIRO sit on climate science, because we've just restructured. We care passionately about climate change, and we are doing a lot. We're just trying to move from the wonderful research we do in collecting data to more applying it. That's all we're trying to do. And there's been a lot of discussion in this area, and we will continue to invest in that area because climate change is very real. I'm not going to get into the whys, but it's real no matter which way you go. And then we're doing a lot in health as well. So that are the 9 areas. Then we have tremendous focus. We have a big marine vessel that travels around the world called the Investigator. We do the Square Kilometre Array, which is space science and astronomy, and that's over in the Nullarbor Plains. Enormous facility that most people don't know about. I don't know how many dishes we've got there, but remember there's one in South Africa and one here, and these are the ones that saw those cosmic waves sort of, you know, going out in the universe. I mean, incredible things that are going to give us deep insight into some of the history of Earth. And also, we've got the Animal and Human Health Lab down in Geelong, where we do investigation into Ebola. We've done all that work into, you know, chicken, animal-borne diseases. And these are very, very high-tech. You've got to go through about 4 levels to get inside everything inside. Everything is like every bit of waste is burned. Amazing sort of capability. So the reason I went through that is, and I'm sorry it took so long, but people don't understand where your tax dollars go. And they are wonderful people doing wonderful things. And if nothing else is, chairman of CSIRO, I want to promote how great it is. So that was what we're doing, and with some of the digital disruption. We've been very active in the National Innovation Science Agenda, which was announced by the Prime Minister in November. Look, it's not going to change the world, but it was a good step forward. And so we've got three areas. First, I mentioned Data 61. We have some of the best data analysts, scientists in the world. There's something like 350 PhDs, computer scientists out there. And if you're any of you in business and you're looking at data analytics, they are some of the best. And they exist only to support industry. So very important what we're doing there. We're also running an accelerator within. An accelerator is just taking ideas, scientific ideas, and trying to get them out into some commercial outcome. It's called ON. And we've just had tremendous results from this. In the last two we've run, we've had 15 new business opportunities. This is CSIRO scientific innovation that we're going to take and commercialize in some way. Now, we want to partner with all the universities because, you know, they're doing their own, but we've got to somehow bring our capability together. But just to give you some of the examples, a new polymer membrane that just reduces enormously water evaporation on plants, which is just transformational. We're doing a lot of work around sensors in crops, so you can actually remotely determine when they're going to mature. Tremendous. We've done quite a lot of work in terms of cloud-based technology, a thing called an analytics, which gives us deep insights into that. I could go on. HoverMap, which is a drone that is able to go and map, you know, different areas, and is quite different in terms of looking at, with cropping, you can get a sense of the geological and the bio state of the crop. Really great. So a large number of ones there. So we're very excited about that. But I do want to say, you know, we've got to address this issue. Great science must somehow make a difference. Now, there will be pure science, but we've got to keep looking for ways to take it through. We need to keep doing both equally. And then we've got a new round. We're just partnering with the universities I mentioned. We've set up an innovation fund, which will be about $100 million. We may take in another $100 million from the private sector, but this is about funding those great ideas and getting them to market because, as you know, what we're a factor of something like 60 or 70 less, you know, early stage funding in Australia compared to the US. It is just unbelievably bad. I'm sure it's because we get such great yields from stocks like Telstra, but the truth is we need more early stage capital to help these new great ideas get to market. And look, unfortunately, it's the success rate's not that great, but if you get it right, it's really very exciting. So the Innovation Fund, so we've got Data 61, we're doing this ON program, and also we're doing this new innovation fund, which I think is very exciting. So that's very different for a government-funded organisation. And, it's difficult and it's challenging within the, public sector, code and, all the rules we've got about how we can really be effective in that, but we're going to give it a go. Now, I just want to finish, lastly, on where we see the world going a little bit, and then we can open it up for questions. Look, it's very important in the world to know where it's going, especially in science. And if you're dealing with, the scientific research world is global. If I talk to our scientists, they talk to researchers in, Fraunhofer in Germany. They'll be talking to the UK. Irrespective of how our structures are, it's a global community. And so we really need to focus on how we become a part of that. The six areas that we're focusing on is firstly in disease management. We're working on technology to fight disease, but they're more about the human body and senses, how we can have early detection of cancer or those sorts of things. You've seen some new medicines come out that are getting far more effective, but what we want is early stage awareness, and a lot of work going into that, and so it really is real time. And we think with sensors and be able to see the behaviour of the body, we can do a lot more. So we're going to put a lot of money into that. Synthetic vaccines are something that are a little bit esoteric, but this is when you write it at the DNA level, quite amazing vaccines that now we can do. And also we'll be doing a lot more in 3D printing around you know, limbs and things like that that can be replaced rather than trying to replace a bone or, you know, sort of lock it together with screws. You can actually replace it. Quite a lot going on there. We're doing a lot, thirdly, a lot in the geological crust, because what we're seeing is we've got to go deeper to find some of the minerals that we need and some of the rare metals that we need. So we're doing a lot of work in the geological crust, and we think that as you go down, we can find different ways of mapping that. I mean, we already map Australia, and in fact, we've got the biggest data pool, they call it. But we have geological data, population data, climate data, and various other bits of data that we can all pull together and start to see trending in terms of what's going on. For example, we can map when there's high phosphate use up in the north, that then goes out to those river systems and hits the Great Barrier Reef. I mean, this is what we need to do, because it's not just looking at climate, it's got to be all the other things that impact it at any one time. We're also doing a lot in terms of network with farmers. We're doing a lot in biological data, because what we find, even if you take something like photosynthesis, which is the most efficient generator of energy, how do you take the principles there and apply it into a commercial opportunity? Really exciting things. And then we've got, you know, the work we're doing around smarter machine connectivity. So I hope what you're seeing is that, you know, this organisation is going places, and we need to celebrate it. And I get, you know, tired of all the criticism that happens. We need to celebrate our scientists and the people who do such great work, and we've got to help them be recognised in some way. Now, do we need to be outcomes driven? Absolutely. Do we need to be held accountable? Absolutely. But we are not, you know, celebrating a lot of what we're doing. So, in summary, what I've just tried to give you is just a little bit of what that 100-year history has actually delivered. And it is a wonderful legacy that we should all be very, very proud of. In fact, we try to refer to CSIRO as our CSIRO, as in our collective CSIRO, bit like my ABC. Why don't we talk about our CSIRO? Because it is great, our CSIRO scientists. And you can see that, you know, all these areas from food, soil, through to water. We've done a lot of work in the Northern Territory. We only capture that water in the Territory and get it down, because there's more than enough water. It just all comes at one time of the year. Right through cybersecurity, energy, manufacturing. It is great. And you see, Billy Hughes' words were just as applicable today as they were back in 1916. Secondly, we're playing a critical role in terms of the national science agenda. I think it's very important we have a strong agenda for science and innovation in this country. It is what creates new industries. It's what changes industries, and we've got to be at the forefront of it. And then lastly, I just went through the six new areas that we're looking at. So, and lastly, I just want to say, more important than any of the above, is we have, you know, a group of people collaborating that actually are inspired about what we do for Australia, not their own state, not their own university, not CSIRO, and we combine together and actually, you know, apply our collective capability. We can be great global leaders in this area. We have wonderful people in this country, well-educated, you know, work well together, but we are not doing it well enough today. And as I said, CSIRO only exists to support industry, partnering with universities and different companies. And if we can do that, I think our future will be really great. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Many thanks to David Thady for a stimulating talk, and thanks also to James Westgarth for the use of this facility today. And so we come to question and discussion, and I just lead off. I mean, how you going as chairman, because you've come from one of the top jobs in Australia, CEO's Telstra, and
right.
Where do you see the role of chairman? I mean, you've got CEO, you've got yourself, you've got a board. Where do you see your role differing from other people?
From Larry Marshall, who's the CEO. The role of the chairman is you know, well, in the private sector, to represent the interests of shareholders, firstly. But in a government agency, our job is to set the direction. I mean, we're very clearly defined because we have an act at CSIRO. We are directed by the minister. We get directions every year. But our job is to support management and all the wonderful professionals to be really good at what they do and to look at long-term planning about where we need to be and endorse that and provide good governance. That's what we do. I'm not the CEO of CSIRO. Dr. Larry Marshall is. But as you know, the most important things that boards do is appoint CEOs as well. So we are probably doing that. So that's what I do. But I do a lot more as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a question of... Come back here, David, and there's a question here.
Yeah. Just I can hear if you're
still out. But if it can't be heard, we'll have to repeat it. Okay?
Yeah. I will repeat it then.
So arguably, one of the most disruptive technologies that's currently progressing in the market is automated vehicles.
Yep.
And with the progress towards fully and highly automated vehicles...
Yeah.
How can we go to industry and say, despite the innovation happening in Silicon Valley in the US in this space, how can they bring the technology to Australia to test it, potentially cybersecurity? Or what role does CSIRO have to kind of encourage more innovation in this country?
Right. Well, we've always been very involved in AI and analytics and things, but let me just talk a little bit about autonomous vehicles. I mean, firstly, in Australia, in Sydney, we have autonomous trains. You all know that. So I think we've got a few just now starting to be rolled out, and so that'll be our reality. Secondly, we have down in Wollongong, we have an autonomous vehicle testing capability. I think it's Wollongong University is doing that. And we've been testing there. That's been under the state government. And then thirdly, we think that probably as we're starting to look at transportation in New South Wales, and I've been involved a little bit of that with the department, is looking at autonomous buses, because buses, especially with the bus lanes, will start there. I think that we need to have a vision for Sydney to be a smart city, is my view. And I think that the government shares that view very strongly. We've got Lucy Turnbull doing the Committee for Sydney in terms of looking at the planning. But we need to have a long-term digital vision for the city that will include, autonomous vehicles. But it's more than that, because you need to put in all these sensors, because the way they work is you need sensors, you need infrastructure to get that right. But that's the vision we've got to have. We've got to make Sydney the most livable city in Asia. And I think we've got to have that aspiration. Now, that means, green areas as well, but we can do lots of different things. So I think we're already doing a lot. But are we going to build a Tesla or have a Tesla here in Australia? I can't see it. We may be able to do something in battery technology, because some really clever things in battery technology. And I think we've got to have a big vision for that. But in terms of building the new generation of vehicles, I'm not sure that that's something we should go after. I think there's others with bigger capital and more efficiency than that. So very important area we should keep going in.
David, is graphite/graphene high up the interest list in CSIRO in your materials section?
Yes, it is. I'm not across what we're specifically doing in that area. I'm aware of graphene from other projects I've been involved in. But I'm not sure. I'm going to talk to the scientist. I'm not a scientist. I was an anthropologist, a reformed technologist anthropologist. Are we doing something in graphene?
I'm an honorary fellow at CSIRO.
You're an honorary fellow, so you know.
I lived 2 years ago. We were definitely doing work with graphene then.
Great.
Yeah. Safety aspects, I think that science might be falling away.
Falling away, yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing that it's very hard to keep across what all those wonderful scientists do. And I have not found anything that the scientists aren't across. I mean, they have a wonderful ability of finding what's going on. Yeah. Okay.
Early in your presentation, you mentioned that science is there to prevent people falling for scams, and yet later on you mentioned that the minister is in charge of CSIRO. How do you reconcile what are two things which are opposite? You've got political interference in the science, and yet you also have to uphold the purity of science.
I don't think it's any different to being a citizen of the country. I'm bound by the government of the year. Now, look, it is a government. It's funded by taxpayers, and you, vote in ministers, and we are humble servants and do that. I don't think that you can, put scam and all the ministers. Most ministers are well-intentioned, wanting to make a difference. Now, yes, there are times when they intervene, but I've never had a problem. And I've worked at Telstra. I've worked in a highly politicised, highly regulated industry, more than most in the room, actually, maybe excepting Stephen. So I've never found a problem, but I keep my own integrity, and I will represent it if I have those discussions. So I don't find a problem there. But maybe you're thinking about something specific, and I don't know.
You emphasise the importance of outcomes and the balance between pure and applied.
Yeah.
And yet where pure science is going to go is far from evident. It's down the track. It cannot be predicted by where it's going to go. And related to that, where do you place astronomy? CSIRO has always put a great deal of emphasis on observing the southern skies, and yet the direct economic outcome of that not evident.
Right. Well, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say. There's some parts of science that may not be able to have a direct commercial outcome. I mean, but CSIRO was set up, to be that bridge between science and industry. Now, look, who knows? Maybe the stars may yield their delights in time, and we may be mining stars or other planets. And maybe it's a little bit far out, but I think it still plays a role in terms of what we do. Astronomy is not one of our nine major divisions. It sits to the side. It is the Square Kilometre Array, and I think we need to keep making sure that we keep that community together. But no, I don't think that's an issue. And look, but yes, there is pure science that we may not see the benefits of in the short term, but that doesn't mean it's not right. I mean, look at the... I'm very familiar with the technology, the computers, and look at, the early days of chip design, which, goes back, literally decades. Or, I talk about Pasteur, but look at Edison. Edison was more driven about outcomes than pure science. So you need to get the balance. Because a lot of people say to me, CSIRO, you've sold out to industry. Well, that's not true. That's what we're there for. But we still invest a lot in pure science, and I love them dearly. We need them to be strong. So I don't find them in conflict. We need to just keep doing both and keep going. And we still need, big companies doing R&D in this country, and we can partner together, because without doing R&D, we will continue to cut costs, we'll be yield-oriented and not growth. And we want to be a growth country. And I worry that at times we're not being, strong enough in going after the new areas. And we'll find some. I'm an optimist by heart.
Mark Patterson?
Yeah.
David, an observation and a question. The observation is that the global Wi-Fi standard was developed by radio astronomers at CSIRO.
Were they radio astronomers? Were they? Well, look at that. You see? That was the reason why we do it.
And it's the largest single financial contribution. Yeah.
I didn't know it was our radio. Yeah, no, it has been incredibly successful. Only one of a number, from polymer notes, a number of other things we've done. Yeah.
The question was linked to that and the commercial outcomes. You spoke of the budget and expenditure for CSIRO and the need to partner with industry and early stage venture capital on those issues. But where's the other side? You've spoken about the expenditure. Where's the returns from that expenditure and commercial sense?
Right. We have in 2014-15, before my time, there was a big project done on what have been the overall benefits of science research from CSIRO. And it was something like a 2.5-3 times multiple, at least, on the long-term investment expenditure. So, even when you look at, I talked about the MOF, the potential there literally is hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. So from an independent view that was reviewed by the government, I think it's more than paid for itself. We just need to keep doing it. The problem is I can't measure my outcomes directly on that every year. Look, this is good. I think that we need to keep recognising. Yeah. Thank you for your question. Yeah. Now, you're at a CSIRO show. You may know things I don't know, so it's pretty challenging. Yeah.
Yes, one thing I do know is I think you got the numbers of CSIRO employees a little exaggerated. I think you said it was 6,000. Currently it's about 4,500.
Actually, I think I said, I don't think I said six, but I did, because I do know this number because we just, we've just done our annual report.
Anyway,
so it's not 6,000, you're right.
I think it's sort of like the horses when the disruptive car came.
5,500.
The graph is actually...
Yeah, it's 5,000. And we did get, when we had the budget cuts under the Abbott era, we had to take 1,000 people out. It was 6.5. We're at 5.5 now, yeah. It's 5.5. It's not full, I'm sure.
My question is, what is the thinking of the government in terms of giving the budget to CSIRO, given that they are saying we're the innovation nation, or wish to be, want to get more and more students going into science, technology and engineering, but are basically cutting, giving a lower budget to CSIRO, which is forcing job cuts, so giving a very poor message to young science enthusiasts.
Well, let me clear my hand. I think there's more than enough money. Are we spending it correctly? I'm not sure we are. That's more the issue. And the other thing is that I think we've got to be very careful when we talk about it. We're restructuring. The actual headcount at SARA is not changing, but we are restructuring. Now, I come from Telstra. I've been restructuring Telstra for the last, well, it's been restructured the last 50 years, because skill sets change. So when we cut in one area, we're rehiring in another area. And in fact, often some of the people who've been at SARA for a long time are leaving with a package and their superannuation. So I think you've got to be careful. We are not cutting people at SARA. It's actually flat. Our funding's flat for the next 3 years. I do give you that we've cut $100 million under the Abbott when the budget was done. Now, but when you look at the $9 billion with R&D tax credits and with in terms of research grants, universities and SARO, there's more than enough money to get done what we need to do. Now, I do agree we need to make science more exciting, and it can be made very boring, and yet science is about life. It's about, you know, how our bodies work. It's about, you know, how things work out there, and we have done a shocking job at that. That's why education has got to change, that we'll do more in STEM. And I'm glad to see a statistic the other day that says that STEM people earn more money than actually many other arts graduates like me, you know. So there's often like this. So I think we get, you know, little bits of data. Do we need to do a better job? Absolutely. And do we need to make it more attractive? But somehow we collectively have not made science attractive in schools. And you go both maths, engineering, science, you know, it's a wasteland. So we've not done something right. And I blame us for that, Anna, because I'm that generation. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Do you think that the digital disruption, it may be an impetus for a move away from cities? You talked about little cities.
Yeah.
Perhaps is there going to be, the first time in centuries, a move away?
Well, I really hope so, because the quality of life's a lot better in some of those regional areas. One of the people on the Jobs New South Wales board is Jane Kay, who runs Bird's Nest. Do you know that? That's that online business out of Cooma. And, gee, I tell you, it's great. You know, real estate's really cheap. She's got a business, I think, turning. She's got about 100 people there. People are staying there. So, yes, technology can change the dynamics of where people are living. So we need to, but we need to work on it. And that's why I think we need regional plans, you know, finding ways to innovate around the technology. So yeah, we need smart, I like smart cities, and I like, you know, good lifestyle and business opportunities in regional areas. In fact, we were just talking about the Hunter region before with the Minister, and I think there's great opportunity. We've got to do more on the South Coast. I mean, I'm talking about just New South Wales, but there's lots of opportunities. I mean, I do think if we can get water management right in some of the more arid areas of Australia, we can start to develop those areas as well. And there's no reason why, you know, we couldn't really make a wonderful sort of set of, you know, new agriculture, new capability out there too. So I agree. Okay.
Question here. David, I've enjoyed your presentation.
Good.
Great way of selling CSIRO. I'm an ex-CSIRO person.
Oh, great. Good. Thank you.
My question relates to the reference you made to the need to get increased
collaboration with industry.
Yeah.
And I would like to know what strategies that you have in place or plan to have
right.
in place to get that greater collaboration so that
right.
we do get better outcomes.
Yeah. Well, look, there's always been, I mean, we even when you would have been there, there's always been a lot of partnership. Like, we had partnerships with Boeing and do all the polymers on every Boeing plane and things like that. But it's interesting, we're trying to be more proactive in reaching out to senior executives and explaining what we do. Because what I've found, I mean, I've only been chairman for 6 months, so I'm a newbie, I'm learning. But I tell you, I am just astounded at the capability that I knew nothing about. And I was, you know, CEO of Telstra, but I didn't know. So if I didn't know, and I'm in the industry. So we're trying to build that capability of how we communicate it. Not trying to oversell it, but just saying, look, we can do things together to really make a difference. Now, when we do that, we've got to be careful. You've got to spend a lot of time. Well, what outcome are we looking for? What skills do we need? Do we really have the skills? Maybe it's not us. Maybe it's the university who's got it. And maybe we need to do it that way and create a collaboration to help. You know, now, we do a lot with Rio. We do a lot with BHP. We do a lot with the banks at the moment in terms of some of the computing. So we are doing a lot. But we need to find people who can translate, work with our scientists and help communicate, because some scientists are great communicators, some aren't, and you know, and each are wonderful. But so we've got to start building that skill, and we are doing, you know, far more classic. I mean, I remember I worked at IBM, and so I know a lot about sales and, you know, relationship management. So we're doing a lot in that area, how we can build those skills and take a more proactive approach. We'll wait and see. But we've got to be careful. And I mean, we're doing that to drive growth. And we can't do it just to drive revenues, because that's the balance point. And yes, we might ask for some payment, but if it becomes purely of that, like in Germany, you have Fraunhofer. Does anyone know the Fraunhofer system? They are all independently, you know, funded a little bit by governments. About 20-80, I think, is about the mix. We're about, what, 70-30-ish. But they seem to work in Germany, and I don't know. I mean, I'd love to think we could be more independent. I'd love to think we had so many great breakthroughs that we would be totally self-funding, that we'd never have to ask for any money. But we haven't quite got there. Wi-Fi was a great one. We like that one. But so that's what we're doing. And also, we've got to keep working hard at the commercialization bit, which is how we, you know, commercialize our IP, because we've got a lot of patents. But some of it's sitting dormant, and we're not, you know, it's always a bit of a hit and miss thing, yeah. So getting this balance is really right. And so the scientists don't feel like they're becoming sold out to, you know, commercial, and at the same time we're being responsible. Yeah. Stephen, no hard questions, please. Yeah.
Congratulations. As you know, I share your passion for the subject and getting science with more outcomes. I've got a bit of a follow-up question.
Yeah.
You and I have moved from industry to academia and science, but that's very, very unusual. I feel like a sort of dinosaur almost at university. How do we get more people?
Yeah.
If you go to America, they switch careers backwards and forwards. We seem to
have
a ceiling.
Yeah.
It makes it difficult.
How can
we change that?
I wish I knew the answer, Stephen, but I mean, as you know, if you're at Stanford or you're at Berkeley or UCLA and you're a professor, it's just natural for you to go out for a couple of years, be in a startup, may or may not work, and you come back. We have a bit of a stigma there, and maybe it's this fear of failure, I don't know. Though I've got to say, often Bill Ferris, you know Bill Ferris is a champ. I mean, I respect Bill enormously, but he often says, we've got this enormous fear of failure. And yet when I go and talk to the miners, they don't have any fear of failure. I mean, maybe they're gamblers, I don't know. But there's no... So I think Australians naturally do want to, you know, sort of step out. But we don't make it easy. Even at CSIRO, if there's a commercial entity, you know, say we've got... Well, let's take something we worked in, efficiency of energy management buildings, and so we created a spin-out. But the people who, when they left that, they had to leave CSIRO. Leave CSIRO, and there was no vehicle back in. And so we didn't create a safety net for them. So they said, oh, you know, I'm not sure. A few went. But we should have said, hey, look, go and give it a go. If it doesn't work out, you know, come on back. And so I think there's some things like that we need to do differently. And we need to, I think it's a lot, I think it's a lot about culture, attitude, and celebrating success, not, you know, penalising failure, because we are very good. All of you are. I am very good at criticising people. And it's the wrong attitude. We need to be, you know, more positive. Now, I don't mean to generalise. I'm just making a point. But, you know, gee, we want people to give it a go. And I think, you know, universities are the same. By the way, I haven't quite made it in the academic ranks yet, Stephen. I've only done science and a bit of business, and, you know, so... Anyway,
final question.
I'm sorry, I wanted to continue. I think you gave, if I may say, a better answer during your talk than you gave just now.
That could be right.
I think the point is, and this is a very important point, just as you said at Stanford and Harvard, in America there's very good connections between universities and industry, and both benefit enormously.
Yes, they do.
In Europe it's not as good. In Australia I'm afraid it's much, much worse.
Yeah.
And to the detriment of both the universities, because the university people would like to have good ideas to work on, and the industry, who would benefit enormously from having connections with people who are imagined.
I couldn't agree more. We are the richer in the dialogue we have, and... I think we need to keep working at it, because we're not good at doing it, and the US are great. And look, I just see the opportunity. I mean, I have been amazed since I left Telstra, and Telstra's a wonderful company, great Australian company, great Australian. I can't solve service issues because I'm no longer there, but it is a great company. We should be celebrating it, and we need to keep celebrating all these wonderful people I've met who are just doing great things, and help them be successful, and that the universities are necessary. Look, thank you very much for your time. I've enjoyed giving the speech, even if it hasn't been that good. Thank you.
Thank you very much to David Thurdy. I mean, as you know, CSIRO is one of the best known names in Australia, but what CSIRO does is not so well known, and David Thurdy, the new chairman in recent times, is... told us what he's planning to do about that. I think it's great that someone in such a high level as business has come into the public sector to chair one of our most important public institutions, going all the way back, I didn't realise, to Billy Hughes in 1916. And it's also, I must say, great to hear a chairman of a public institution saying that they've got enough money, provided it's spent properly, and that's very refreshing, because I think it's more likely to lead to more money if you say you're not campaigning for money all the time, so that was great as well. Look, thanks for a terrific presentation tonight. I think you've got a very important message to deliver to all Australians, and I'm very pleased you were able to spend some time here tonight at the Sydney Institute doing that in your 100th year. Well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.